You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Sacramento County has elected a new district attorney. Tian Ho has been with the Sac County DA's office for nearly two decades, known for prosecuting the Golden State Killer trial, conviction, and sentencing of Joseph DeAngelo, also known as the East Area Rapist. But to some residents, he may be an unfamiliar name. I sat down with District Attorney-elect Tian Ho about his lived experiences that shaped a career in law, and what the county's 1.5 million residents can expect from its top prosecutor. So I want to go back to May, when CAP Radio asked you why you decided to run for office. You said the where answers the who and ultimately answers the why. Mm-hmm. So I want to get into the who and the where of Tian Ho.
So let me kind of just talk about in terms of who, because I think where we grow up, where we came from, our families, our communities that we grow up in really kind of shape who we are in our future. So I was actually born in Vietnam. And as many people know, in 1975, when South Vietnam fell to the communist North, the communists came in and they arrested my uncle who worked for the South Vietnamese government. Without a jury, without a judge, without a prosecutor, they sent him to a re-education camp in the jungle where he was tortured for 7 years. So in 1976, when I was almost 5 years old, my parents decided that we needed to escape Vietnam. So my mom and my dad, along with some of their friends and families, about 30, 40 people, they pull their money together to buy a fishing boat. A couple of days before we escape, I'm sitting there and I noticed that my dad had taken my favorite toy in the whole wide world, which is this little plastic gun, and he was painting it black. And so I'm like, Dad, what are you doing? And he just laughed. Well, my dad also stole a uniform from a communist officer. So the night that we escaped from Vietnam, they took my two-month-old brother, put him in a cardboard box and punched holes in it so he could breathe. We snuck aboard the boat, about 40 of us, 30, 40, and we're all below decked, except for my dad, who's up on deck with the captain. My dad's wearing the stolen officer uniform and the fake gun in the holster. So you have to go through these series of checkpoints in the Delta to get out to sea. Along the way, we got stopped at a military checkpoint. And the guard asked my dad, why are you out here? Dad says, oh, I just bought this boat from this captain here. I'm on a cruise checking out the boat with my wife and my two boys who are below deck. And the guard says, no, I think you have a bunch of refugees below and I want to search right here, right now. My dad looked at him and says, all right, go ahead, look. If you find a bunch of refugees, and there's like 40 of us, if you find a bunch of refugees, you can kill all of us, starting with me. But if you look down there and all you see is my wife and my two boys, I'm going to take this gun, and he's pointing to the fake plastic gun, and I'm going to blow your brains out. How dare you even question me? I outrank you. And he's pointing to the stolen uniform. So my dad, he had never gambled in his life before until that moment. So the guard kind of looked at my dad for a moment, kind of paused, looked around, and then he said, nah, we don't need to look. Why don't you come back here for a drink? And if you know anything about Vietnamese people, we love our cognac. So they're having cognac back there, and we're all below deck freaking out. My dad made it back. We made it out to sea. The problem was the captain of the boat, his family got stuck on shore. So he jumped off the ship, and he swam back, and he left us. So now they have to make a decision. We're trying to make it across the South China Sea to the Philippines. And nobody on that boat knew how to navigate the open sea. My dad was a school teacher. So they were talking, maybe we should turn back. But if you turn back and you got caught, you're dead. So they decided to make a run for it. Well, we ran out of gas, ran out of food, ran out of water. We were just drifting on the ocean aimlessly for almost 3 weeks until we were rescued by a French merchant ship. Took us to a refugee camp in Malaysia. So we were sponsored, my family and I, my parents and I, to Stockton. And when we moved to Stockton, lived in a little apartment off of Hammer Lane, we didn't even have a bed to sleep on, so my dad said, all right, let's go. My dad and I found a mattress somebody threw away next to the garbage bin. That's what the four of us slept on. I didn't know how to speak English at all. So I learned how to speak English by watching Bugs Bunny cartoons. 22 years later, graduated from law school. And so when I look back at my family's history, whether it was my grandmother who was executed by the communists without a judge, jury, or prosecutor, whether it was my uncle who was taken and sent away and tortured without a judge, jury, or prosecutor, one of the reasons about why I decided to become a lawyer and to run for district attorney is that the district attorney is the gatekeeper to our system of justice. We're the first and last person to ever see a case. And we are there to make sure that the system of justice treats everybody equally and fairly. And this country has afforded myself and my family all the opportunities and the freedoms in the world. And it gets to a certain point that you have to give back to the community.
Hmm. The fact that you are the first person of color to be a district attorney in Sacramento County, and you just shared a very powerful lived experience at such a young age, not even 5 years old, what do you think that adds to the role of leading the county as the top prosecutor?
You know, I think we are shaped by our life experiences. I'm an immigrant, a refugee. I'm a person of color. I had to learn English. I grew up poor, worried about where the next meal was coming from. It gives me a perspective of that. In addition, I've also been a victim of violent crime. My family, we were victims of an attempted home invasion robbery. I've been a victim of a drive-by shooting. So I know what it's like to be a victim of a crime. And when you look at crime, you know, it disproportionately affects people from marginalized communities. It's particularly violent crimes. It's not affecting to the same degree those that live behind, you know, a gated community somewhere with guards. No, it affects the vast majority of the people, and in particular people from marginalized communities. And so when we're talking about crime, when we're talking about public safety, we have to make sure that we look at it in that sense as well. And as somebody who, and I've given the statistic out before, there are approximately 2,400 elected district attorneys across the entire country. And of that, there are only 8, and I will be the 9th current, that are of API descent. And so we talk about making sure that we have a seat at the table, or else you end up on the menu.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you need to take it to another level. You not only need to have a seat at the table, you need to have a voice at the table to determine what is on the menu. Right? So that you can have a say in policy decision making, in terms of shaping the culture, the view of the office, and public safety for all communities, and making sure that everyone feels included and that everyone feels safe, because public safety is a right that is entitled by all communities, not just some communities. And it's both those who are accused of crimes, but those that are victims of crimes. We can't forget both of those sides.
So you're the 9th now. Currently, mm-hmm. I want to go back to 1998 when you became a prosecutor. Mm-hmm. How was being a member of the AAPI community? How was that like, really being a minority in a field that was, I'm going to go, likely white and male, most likely at that time? Well, did you receive any resistance?
So I can tell you that among my colleagues in the DA's office, it was welcoming. It was inclusive. You know, you have your bands of, you know, your band of brothers and sisters there, you know, going through the process, helping the community. None there at all. But what you do notice is that I have very few role models growing up in the legal profession. I didn't know anybody who was a lawyer in my family. And even in the community, there was maybe one, but that was it. So there's no, where do you look for in terms of a role model? Where do you look for in terms of what to model yourself, to look at, to have goals, mentorship? There was none. And so, you know, if you remember, you know, Michael Jordan, he had a slogan, be like Mike, right? And so there was nobody to be like. And so the only thing that you could be at the end of the day, and I think it was good for me, was to be myself. You know, and I think as you go through life, you have to find your own voice and identity. I will say this, that, you know, there's an interesting story when we talk about in terms of just perception. So I've been a prosecutor here in Sacramento for almost 20 years. And so a couple of years ago, I was now worked my way through the office, and I am now the supervisor of the gang team, one of the most elite teams in the office, the supervisor of the major narcotic team of the hate crime unit. And I'm wearing a suit and tie. I'm walking down the hallway in the courthouse, suit and tie, supervisor, been there for years, tried, you know, nearly 100 jury trials or 100 trials. And so I'm walking down, and I have some defense attorney yelling out at me. And he says, are you the interpreter? And as I get closer, and I'm ignoring him, I'm trying to stay calm. Are you the interpreter? I don't say anything. And he starts screaming, are you the Chinese interpreter? And so I get right up to him, and he's like yelling at me now. And I said, I am not the effing interpreter, right? And so, you know, there is that perception. Is somebody else who is not Asian going to get that comment? I mean, I've been working here 18 years. I'm in this position, and yet I'm still viewed by this defense attorney as the interpreter. So when we talk about making history. When we talk about the position of the district attorney, there are only 58 in the entire state. I think it is a monumental achievement for the community. I'm not focused on the individual, but for the community. I think it's important.
When talking about the community, you were the lead prosecutor of one of the largest criminal cases in California history, the Golden mm-hmm. State Killer, East Area Rapist. I covered that trial until the sentencing. You've said in the past that when you reflect on this, you don't think about the national media attention mm-hmm. or the documentaries, but how do you reflect on this period in your career?
So I'll tell you a little bit about one story that I think really resonated with. You know, Joseph DeAngelo killed 13 people. Raped upwards of 50 people, committed 120 burglaries in 11 jurisdictions up and down the state of California. His reign of terror was pervasive. He is the worst of the worst. He is a monster. And so as we were looking at the case, we sought the death penalty. And there are strong disagreement and passionate disagreement among some people in regards to the death penalty. But I thought if anybody ever deserved the death penalty, it was him. And for all the wreck and the carnage and the pain that he caused. And as we were proceeding on the case, I believed that he deserved it. And at one point, we took it off the table. And initially, I was against it. Because if anybody deserved it, it was him. And then what happened was, as we go to court, and I'll paint the scene for you. Very first day we go to court, that I go to court after getting assigned the case, there was a lady that walked up to me. Her name is Phyllis, and she's identified herself, and she was on TV and in the media. She was the very first sexual assault victim in Sacramento and Rancho Cordova. So Phyllis would come up. She introduced herself, shake my hand, and every single time she would be there. Every time she would shake my hand. Every time I sit down and I catch up with her, you know, how are you doing, Phyllis? You know, this is what's going on today, and I'll, you know, this is what's going to happen, and then I talk to her afterwards. Every single time she was there. And near the end of the case, she can't, you know, what happened was she wasn't there anymore. She had cancer. She was diagnosed with cancer, and she was going through chemo and radiation. And there was this empty seat every time in court. And so as we were getting ready to resolve the case, and he pled guilty to all these counts of murder, admitted committing all these rapes and these crimes, and he's going to go away forever. Multiple life without the possibility of parole sentences forever. And so we're in the Sac State Ballroom because we're in the middle of COVID in 2020. You had to be 6 feet apart. And mind you, we have so—
I remember, I was there.
You were there. We had so many victims, right? And so many people from the media, the police, the everybody. And we couldn't just fit in a courtroom, and you had to— we needed to give the victims a place and an opportunity to be there and get closure in their life. And so when you take a plea, you have to read the factual basis of what the defendant did in that particular case. And so for each one of the cases, each victim stood up on their case. But because Phyllis was going through chemo and radiation, she couldn't be there. So when it was time for the factual basis for her plea, all the other victims stood up for her. That was such a moving moment. Now, fast forward about maybe 2 months, 2.5 months later, we're back in the Sac State Ballroom. He's about to get sentenced and sent off to prison. I don't know if you, were you there then?
Yeah, I was there.
I'm sitting there. I'm kind of watching the entire ballroom. And I'm sitting on the left as you're facing the stage. And I look over to my right, way over on the other side. And I see Phyllis. And she had this beautiful, beaming smile on her face. A few months later, she passed away from cancer. So if we had sought the death penalty, if we had kept going on the case, she would have never gotten her day in court, never gotten that closure before she passed away. And so many of these other victims. And so when I think about the case, I think about the detective that when he retired, became a private investigator and was following people, trying to look down leads. I think about the law enforcement officers and the other people that never gave up on the case and kept working on it to find closure, to bring them to justice and give closure, some measure of it to each of these victims and to Phyllis. And so when I think about it, I think of Phyllis. That's what I think of.
During that period in the last 6 years, another major assignment that the district attorney's office also took on was mm-hmm. whether to charge the officers in the shooting death of Stephon Clark. District Attorney Schubert mm-hmm. ultimately decided not to. During mm-hmm. your campaign, Cap Radio asked you about that. You said it was extremely tragic. Mm-hmm. It was heartbreaking. But ultimately, the DA's decision was evaluated. It was upheld at both the state and the federal level. But I'm just curious, because you also are an adjunct professor, so mm-hmm. you teach law. Mm-hmm. You also have more than 20 years of experience as a prosecutor. Mm-hmm. How do you reconcile following the facts and the law when the outcome is also extremely tragic and heartbreaking?
You know, I prosecuted sex crimes for many years. Child molestation cases, rape cases, they take an emotional toll on you. We're human beings. It's very difficult to separate your emotions, but you have to do so because justice requires it. The victim requires it. The defendant who is possibly accused of a crime requires it. You don't want somebody making a decision about life and death, about prison, about jail, about justice, about freedom, about liberty, about all those things based on emotion. And we are emotional creatures. That's who we are. That's what separates us from a rock that sits in my backyard. And it gives us our humanity. And we must never lose touch with our humanity. But when it comes to the analyzing something, you have to look at the facts and the law. That's where it starts. That's where it ends. But all around it, in terms of how you deal with people and how you talk to people, that's where the humanity and the empathy always comes in, and the understanding of where it fits in into our community.
Are the laws limiting, though, and would you like them to be improved in this case? And it's not isolated. He was unarmed and running away from officers.
You know, if we were to talk about that case, and remember, every single case, you have to look at the facts of every single case. He was running away from officers. But at that point in time, if you're looking at it just from a legal analysis, and you watch the video, at that point, he was advancing on the officers. At that moment, right before the shots were fired, he was in a position with his hands up, and then he advanced on the took. When I say advance, and
right, it wasn't like he did not charge. It was a very slight movement when you watch the video.
I think when we say, now I'm using legal terms, not legal terms, but jargon. So let me kind of just use simple term. He moved towards, okay, whether it was however far. It was visible in terms of a movement towards. So advance is probably too technical of a term. And so you have to look at all that. So whether you look at the law or not, at the end of the day, it's the facts of the case really drives every single case is what it is. And, you know, those things are heartbreaking for the community. And you always have to recognize that for first and foremost, for his family, for anybody's, you know, family.
And this is just one example. There are other examples mm-hmm. as well, not only in Sacramento, across the country. There is a reckoning that's bringing people out onto the streets for racial justice, some advocating for police reform. What do you take from that as a prosecutor when some would argue that trust is being fractured, especially with underserved communities?
I think one of the things is, and I feel it, and I sense it, and I see it, and I hear it in terms of fractured trust with certain communities, particularly marginalized communities. And those communities are also the ones that are most affected by crime as well, both as defendants and victims of crimes. So how do you bridge that trust and that gap, right? So one of the ideas that I have, and we currently don't have this in place, is I want to have an advisory council. So the vision is to have a large advisory council, but I think that we need to have smaller advisory councils, perhaps one for the Asian community, one for the Latino community, one for the African-American community, maybe the business community, LGBTQ, different communities. And they each have, remember, we are unique in terms of our experiences. We have a lot in common, but sometimes they're unique and different. So each of those committees will then pick somebody themselves, vote somebody to sit on the larger council, right, that will then have an advisory role with myself as the district attorney so that I have an opportunity not to talk, but to listen. And I think that we need to do more listening. And if we do a lot of listening, and engagement in that sense, and being out in the community and also having the community with us. I think that's the first step in terms of bridging trust, is seeing each other more, talking to each other more, listening to each other. It's a very basic human thing. If you and I have talked like 6-12 times, by the end of it, we're going to have a level of just commonality and familiarity, that so we can have a conversation and talk about things openly and address things. And so I think that it starts first there, because I do sense that gap that needs to be bridged.
The fact that you've been with the Sacramento County District Attorney's Office for nearly 20 years, I believe you joined in 2004, what should residents expect? Will this be a continuation of a district attorney's office under DA Schubert?
I think that one of the things that we do, and we do well, is prosecute violent crimes. We've done that, and I've done that consistently over time as well. But there are things that, you know, such as the advisory council that I want to institute. Another idea that I've had that I've talked about is a form of a neighborhood court for low-level offenses. Yolo County has such a program. I also want to work and expand in terms of juvenile work, especially in the areas with trades and training and foster kids, to get them some sort of vocational training while they're in the system, so that when they time out of the system or they're off probation, that they have a hope in the future, and how we can collaborate with the schools on that, and the school board and juvenile hall and the trades. There's different things there. And the other thing is, at some point, it's not at some point, we need to address the homeless crisis. We all see it. We all feel it. First and foremost, I believe that homelessness should not be criminalized. But I think there's an intersection there when we come with mental health and drug addiction and public safety. How do we deal with that? How do we help those that are going through mental health and drug addiction, and some that commit crimes? How do we deal with that to make sure that there is a path towards rehabilitation? And so I don't know if we talked about this last time, but we have a program at the DA's office called the CORE program, C-O-R-E. What that is if you have somebody, and they don't have to be homeless, but let's say they have 10 offenses or more. It could be trespassing, it could be battery, it could be vandalism. Each in these cases individually on their own, because of the changes in the law, don't amount to much in terms of sentencing. But what happens if they have 10 or more, and we have some that have many, many more? And what's fueling it could be drug addiction and mental health. And it's that vicious cycle. Was it the mental health that caused the drug addiction? Was it the drug addiction that caused the mental health? Who knows? But at the end of the day, they have both. And some of it spirals out into criminal activity. And so if they have 10 or more offenses, what we do is we work with law enforcement. We try to offer services first. And then what we do is, if they have 10 or more offenses, they are at that point taken to jail. And so then what we do is we work with their defense attorney and the court, and we say, look, you can deal with these 10 cases, because now they're 10 cases, and stay in jail, or you can go into a drug treatment program. We find out what is the underlying causality of the criminogenic behavior. And if it's drug addiction, you can go into a drug treatment program, or you can stay. Which one would you want? Okay, I want the drug treatment program. So what we do, and we did it recently, we had the sheriff's department take that individual and transport them to the drug treatment program. Now, if they run, they escape, they don't finish the program, they go back to jail and they have to deal with the case. But if they finish it, then they don't do another day of jail. They get put on probation and make sure that we try to get them services and continuous services on it. But that is a process that we're trying to work on. Now, one of the issues we're running across is, and I know Governor Newsom is looking at the CARE court, right? We need more treatment beds. We don't have enough treatment beds, whether it's mental health or drug addiction. We simply need more. There's just a lack of beds. There's a lack of clinicians working in it. We're at just that point, but we need more treatment beds.
Well, this week, the county board of supervisors approved two laws banning homeless encampments along the American River and Dry Creek Parkways. Where do you stand on this? Because currently at the time, I mean, there's the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decision from Boise that you can't criminalize or encampments if there aren't enough spaces for people. There's not enough shelter for people. And clearly, there's not only not enough shelter, there's not enough resources.
So it's a really challenging question and how you balance everything. So I've read the Boise decision several times. And I encourage people to read the decision. I do it because I'm a lawyer. That's what we do. We read cases. But when you read through the case, the Boise decision says, bottom line, it says you can't outlaw camping all the time in all places. So let me say that again. You can't do it all the time in all places. Now, you can do it some of the time in some places. So when you look at it, it is a limited decision in that sense. So you can do it in some of the times in some places, but you can't do it all the time in all places unless you have shelter. And it's this balance where we have compassion and we're getting treatment. But the other side of it, and I'll give an example, you have levees. You have levees out in the Thomas that protect an entire community. You have levees along the river. And sometimes you have people, what do you do if somebody's burrow into the levee and they're undermining the levee? And I know that we don't have a lot of rain right now, but there'll come a time and a place where you have that, where you have fires that are set. So how do you balance out the environmental damage and the public safety issue of damaging the infrastructure in the levee with compassion as well, right? It's that balancing factor of all those things where, yes, we need more treatment beds. Yes, we need more shelter. But at the same time, we also have to balance where you can't have the levee being undermined, because that just, you'd have flooding downtown, you have flooding here.
You're also going to be working in tandem with the Sacramento County Sheriff's Office, mm-hmm. and this is a new era. We also have Sheriff-elect Jim Cooper. What conversations have you been having with him?
So a couple of conversations. I've known Sheriff-elect Cooper for many years. He was in the Sheriff's Department first, and I think he was also the mayor at one point, I think, in Elk Grove.
He was.
And then he went to the Assembly. So I've worked with Slimman Cooper on a number of different bills and things, and so I think we'll have a collaborative working experience. And my thing is, I'm a very bottom line sort of person. I can talk to anybody, work with anybody, and I want to just get stuff done. And that's kind of my goal. And I want to just open conversations with people. And I want honest opinions about things, even if they vehemently disagree with me, because that may open my mind. It may change my mind. It may give me another perspective. And at the end of the day, I may or may not agree with it, but I think we are all the better by engaging in dialogue and discussion with each other and working with each other. I'm fond of saying that a rising tide lifts all ships, and that's what we are. We need to lift each other up together.
District Attorney-elect Hope, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, as always, and please let me know if you ever want me to come back.
January 2024.
All right. Thank you.
1 year in.
All right. Thank you very much.
Sacramento County District Attorney-elect Tian Ho will be sworn in this coming January. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.